Welcome everyone to the October 28th, 2020 A to Z and Platinum call. It is the end of October. I don't know why that just blows my mind, but it does blow my mind. But here we are. I just wanted to get us started on time because we had some questions mailed in. It looks like questions are already coming in. Terrific. Okay, it looks like we already have some things going on. Sarah, do you want to unmute yourself? Sarah and I was just admiring her litter before everybody jumped on. Sorry, I needed a puppy fix. So lecithin throughout lactation. Yeah. Oh, there's one. Nice healthy puppy for a litter of 13. That's a good size puppy.
Well, 12.
12, sorry. So lecithin as long as she's nursing, maybe at the very, very end, you know, when those mammary glands sort of become really flaccid and the chance that you're going to get mastitis goes way down. Other than that, it's kind of a cheap. It doesn't work 100%, but it's better than anything else we have on avoiding mastitis.
Okay.
And then post-whelping calcium supplementation is needed as long as your bitch needs it. And it's a little hard to predict, but you can try reducing the amount. And if you see her begin to have behavioral problems, the only reason we need it is for those aberrant behaviors, leaving the box, burying puppies, moving puppies, aggression, things like that. That sort of that anxiety where they just can't settle down. All of that is the focus of calcium supplementation. Some bitches never need it at all. And some bitches need a whole lot of it. And there's really no way to predict it. And I'm just a believer that if they need it, let's give it to them. And if they don't need it, wean them off of it.
Okay.
And the other thing is that you may find that it rises and falls. So her peak lactation is going to be 3 to 5 weeks. She's not at peak lactation yet. So she may be fine if you cut back now, but you may see that at 4 weeks, the drain on her body is such that you need to resupplement. The one thing about calcium, Tracy Calhoun always says, it's like pain management. We don't ever want to get behind it. It's harder to catch back up to low calcium than it is to stay on it. So play with it. With our last litter, we gave Doc Roy's tablets with every meal, but we wouldn't always give calcium citrate or more Doc Roy's between meals if we were saying that she was really stable. In fact, she was kind of odd. I don't know if anybody else's bitch would do this. She would actually come and ask for it when she began to feel weird. She would come in and it took us a while to figure it out, but she would just stand there and we would figure out. Now, maybe it was the golden retriever who really liked Doc Roy's and was asking for a cookie. But most of the time I got the feeling that she was asking because she was beginning to feel really strange. So that's an option, you know, do a consistent amount with her meals and then do a surge amount in between.
Okay. All right.
Cool. Does she do much now? Are you giving much now?
So initially the first week she was getting, 12 scoops a day of the powder of Doc Roy's. And now I've actually cut her back to 9 scoops and I'm not seeing any behavioral issues or physical issues. And she's right here with all the puppies and then I've got, you know, so
you're not seeing. So I think the most important thing as we begin to cut back is that we really imprint in our head that when we see an odd behavior, the first thing we do is give calcium. Okay. You know, a lot of times we're like, huh, I wonder if she has to go out or I wonder if she has to poop or she seems a little weird today. And it takes us a while to say, darn, I need to give her calcium. And so the more we can in our head say, number one step is more calcium. Number two is take her outside or something like that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. Renee says she had a bitch that would stand up in her box and hold a toy asking for calcium. I agree. It's really weird, but I think more bitches do it than perhaps we realize. Okay, Sylvia. Sylvia has a question about cryptorchidism. Hey, Sylvia, how are you?
Hey, good. All right, so in my litter of seven, I had five boys and two girls. At 8 weeks, all five boys, none of them had dropped.
Is that common in your breed?
No.
Okay.
So eventually... one, the pick boy, thankfully, dropped. None of the others have dropped.
How old are they?
They are 14 weeks now.
Oh, okay.
So I mean, we still have time.
Yeah, but still.
But still, yes. And especially because a couple of them are turning out really nice.
Yeah, yeah. Did you see the file I put up about cryptorchidism?
No, one of my questions was going to be, do we have information somewhere that I can go and look at? And then do we know what, I get conflicting, do we know what causes it or not? And is there anything that can be done about it? Somebody mentioned a shot, but that it's too late now. And so I just as much information as I can learn. We did do Regimate on her, but we did it late term. So I didn't know if that had an effect. So I'm just as much information as I can glean. And is there anything that can be done?
Okay. The first question I'm going to ask everybody is, did anybody see the file I put up on the Facebook page yesterday? Because now I'm wondering if it got there. I'm not seeing any yeses. So Sylvia, I do have a paper on cryptorchidism, and I will... I will get it up today afterwards. And it sort of goes through how I think about cryptorchidism. Now, you can think about cryptorchidism in a different way, but I basically lay it out based on, I don't know if you've read the book Controlling Canine Genetic Diseases, where they have a hierarchy of diseases. Number one disease is fatal, two are pain throughout the dog's life, et cetera, down to, you know, a spot in the wrong place, a disease or a trait that doesn't really have any impact on the dog. So cryptorchidism is very low in the impact on the dog. It is higher in the impact on the breed for the very reason that you're saying, that it takes dogs out of the gene pool. But the dog himself, aside from he will need to be either neutered or ultrasounded every year after five or six. It's not a particularly early cancer that comes, but there is a higher risk. I think it's somewhere around 17% that those testicles will develop cancer. So, you know, there is that slight additional cost, but there's no real cost to the dog other than he's probably never going to breed. He still has enough testosterone to be a male. The other testicle is fine, which means they are not sterile unless both testicles are retained. If both testicles are retained, the dog is sterile. If only one is retained, the dog is far from sterile. So I think that we have to, as breeders, say, how aggressively are we going to go after this issue relative to the other issues in our breed? And a lot of it's going to depend upon the issues you have in your breed. If you don't have any, then maybe cryptorchidism rises to the top. If it's a breed like mine, where 60% of them are dying of cancer, cryptorchidism drops lower in my priority list. But it does affect your breeding program because it takes dogs out of it. I believe in every registry in the world, crypt orchids can't be shown. That doesn't mean they can't be bred. You can register dogs that are sired by crypt orchids, but it is, it's a pretty strong trait. And interestingly enough, lines that have crypt orchidism tend to have larger litters and more males. So there is this thinking that we that gene actually results in better fertility, except of those males, many of them are going to be crypt orchid. So I know that's a little bit confusing, but that's so a little bit about thinking about.
There's no evidence of it in the sire or the dam's lines previously.
So how many dogs, male dogs are you talking about that weren't neutered? Like, what is the N of the dogs? When we say we don't have any history in the lines, I mean, we'll be lucky to get, if a bitch has 20 puppies, probably only 10 of them are males. That's too small a number to actually know if she carries the gene or not. Okay. Similarly with the sire. I mean, they would have to produce, if they produce 100 puppies, then they probably produced 48 males. And of them, how many weren't neutered before the opportunity to have that testicle come down? Because, you know, it's really the first 6 to 12 months is really what we're looking at. So a lot of times people say we don't have any evidence, but there's not enough numbers for us to actually know if there's evidence or not. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But it does seem, there does seem to be a genetic component.
Yeah. So there is. So there definitely is some thought on a number of contributors. So just for us to put in place, 2% of baby boys are crypt orchids. Human baby boys are crypt orchids. That's actually a fair number. Anybody ever heard of it before? No, because they just go in and fix it by the time the baby's a year old, and thus it continues on. So it's interesting that it is catastrophic in dogs in our view, and yet not at all catastrophic in human beings. So in humans, we know that being premature increases the risk of crypt orchidism massively. There is some evidence that there are environmental factors, but the belief is those are pretty low. And the issue is in the environment and in food endocrine inhibitors. We don't know if that's affecting our dogs because we just don't have enough information. It's hard to track crypt orchid dogs. Most of them are neutered pretty quickly. So in studies, the heritability of crypt orchidism is 0.23. That is about the same as hip dysplasia. And so we obviously strongly believe that hip dysplasia is inherited. And so I think given the similarity in numbers, we need to believe that crypt orchidism is. And the reason I suspect that you're getting conflicting information is that it is inherited differently among breeds. So in some breeds, it is most likely a simple recessive. And in others, it is probably not. It's probably polygenic. And I would guess for you, it's polygenic because if you think about it, there's late descent, there is length of the cords, there is size of the opening, the ring. There are all these things that contribute to whether those testicles can get down or not. And so the fact that it is polygenic makes a lot of sense. In most cases in the research, and I've got some of the research listed in the paper that I'll put up, The belief is that it is carried by both parents. And now that doesn't make it a simple recessive, but that both bitches and dogs contribute. But our problem obviously is we can only see it in dogs. And so we often aren't analyzing our bitch lines to get an idea if they are carriers or not. But if by six, wherever you want to call it, 6 or 9 months, you have a single puppy in the litter that is cryptorchid, then both parents carry the gene. And so thinking about how you're going to breed with that is really important. That for me doesn't, being a carrier or having one of the genes doesn't remove a dog from my breeding program, but I'm pretty cautious about future breedings. Obviously, each of us have to make that own, our own decision on that. In some rare breeds, there's a likelihood that they're breeding cryptorchids. And I have to tell you, in at least English Cockers, it is a phenomenally common problem. And they just fix it. They fix it before the puppy is 16 weeks old. Now, fixing, if it requires any kind of surgery, is against AKC regulations. And the dog, if you're found out, the dog will be unregistered and you will be fined, et cetera. But does it happen? It happens a lot. And because it happens a lot and we don't know about it, it continues on. If it's a problem that we know about, we're more able or better able to breed around it. I don't think Renee put up the, is it Sister Roland? Renee, is that how it's pronounced? Sister Roland? Yeah, no. I don't know if I'm saying it right. Yeah. I don't think those injections are against the AKC guidance, but it's not. Yeah. So it's allowed. I don't know much about it. So I would have to, maybe Renee can chime in. Hutch in the past recommended when neutering to determine if it's short cord or the testicle got stuck. Yep. Oh, that, yeah. So he says if it's a short cord, remove it from the breeding program. Yeah. It's, if you're going to, you could leave the dog in the breeding program, but it also will inform brothers, sisters, and parents if it's a short cord or whether, you know, it was in the wrong place when the ring closed, et cetera, or it happened. Some of them go up and down, and if they happen to go up as the ring is closing, then it's not going to get back down again. Jen says the cryptorchid question would be good to send to Dr. Hutch. Yeah, that's actually really true. I would get his input on it. I'm sure he has more knowledge about it than I do. Go ahead, Sylvia. Yep.
I just heard this hearsay. Have you heard of anything about the slower the descending testicle, that future generations, it becomes slower and slower, and pretty soon you have a cryptorchid dog in the future generations?
Well, I don't know that it continues to get worse, but it is an inherited trait when those testicles come down. So if, yeah, it came down, but it came down, like I had one that came down on his 6-month birthday. I did not breed him. That was just too agonizingly long to wait and not continue it. So if you start selecting those boys with later and later descent, then the likelihood you're going to continue to get later and later descent is higher. So I don't know. I can't imagine that it would get worse in generations. I mean, the gene isn't going to change, but if by chance you begin line breeding on that dog, and so the bitch carries later descent and the dog carries later descent, likelihood you're just going to get later and later descent. So that might be the mechanism of that. What else?
So two questions. When you say fix, other than surgery, what are fix? Like, what do those shots do?
That I'm going to let Renee, if she's still on. No, I don't see her. I don't know the answer to that. That would be a really good question when I, oh, there she is. Hi, Renee. I lost you. You're like doing.
I'm at work on lunch trying to hide from everybody.
I got it.
The Sister Ellen injections are 2 injections a week apart. We've had mixed to poor success with it, but it gives breeders the option to feel like they've done something to do it. Interestingly enough, the most recent cases was actually a bitch that had Regimate later on too.
Interesting.
So that's kind of interesting to hear. My Regimate bitch did not have any retained testicles, but most recently I had a large breed dog with a couple.
That's interesting. And do you know what the Sisterolin does?
Sisterolin, and his came down. I don't remember with enough confidence to say right now, but I can look it up later on.
Yeah. Yeah. We can definitely worth a conversation, Sylvia, in the Facebook group, because it is a really common problem across many, many, many breeds. And it's often one of those ones we don't talk about much because, you know, everybody's kind of hyper about it. But definitely worth having a conversation about and thinking about either how you can breed away from it or how you can manage it. Or in our case, we can track Regimate and see if we're beginning to see a trend there.
Yeah, because we've had to do the Regimate all 3 times. But of course, the first 2 were singletons with girls. So we don't know. This was her first full litter. And it was mostly boys. So... So we'll see where it goes from here, but I'm sure hoping it's not an indication that there's a problem with the line. But yeah, I'm curious on the Regimate if that could be causing part of the problem.
Yeah, definitely worth tracking. And you know, like all of us could track it because it's your chance that you're going to have enough dogs that have to have it to be able to figure out if it's contributing and have litters with enough boys. You know, it's one of those really complicated traits because it only expresses itself in a small percentage of boys. But I'll tell you, Sylvia, my second litter, I did a line breeding back to a fabulous dog. And sure enough, 100% of the litter was Crypt Orchid. And, it was, you know, for your second litter, it was pretty depressing. but
of course, as you know, I'm getting started. I'm new, but this was not a line breeding. This was an outcrop. So,
yeah, it really depends upon where those genes are and how well previous breeders really tracked it. Because a lot of times we just place them in pet homes at 8 weeks. And they're neutered by 6 months, and we may not know if it came down or not. I had a conversation, I think it was like 4 or 5 months ago, with someone who was trying to get one of their owners to figure out if the dog had 2 testicles. And it was a single guy, and he was not checking. And he was too embarrassed to go in and ask his vet to do it. So the breeder never found out whether there were 2 testicles there or not. You know, if you think about the challenges of just having those conversations with your owners, getting them to check regularly, goodness, if you've ever tried to convince owners to help the testicle down, like find it, because massage can help. You can definitely work testicles in some cases, work them down. You know, you try and have that conversation with some of your owners and it can be a little mortifying. So just saying, but you know, any puppy that's with you where you're not seeing testicles by 7 or 8 weeks, that's the time for some massage. See if you can find the testicles and start working them towards the scrotum, because you can definitely impact that.
Okay, good to know. We couldn't find them at all. The vet could not find them at all at 8 weeks, none of them. And then at 10 weeks, the one boy finally started dropping, and he's the only one so far.
Challenging. Well, look for that paper and let's have a conversation on the Facebook page.
Thank you.
Sounds good. And ask Hutch if you're going to be on the call tomorrow.
Yes, I will.
I have a question about that, Gail.
Yeah.
Hey, Deb. I came late. I don't know. Would that just be passed to the male line, or would the female, the mom, pass it to the female and then it would be passed to?
Correct. Yeah, it is not a trait only found in male genes. It is just a trait that is only expressed by males.
Gotcha. Thanks.
So bitches carry it. And that's one of our big challenges, is how to figure that out.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So I see Jim's question. How long is semen viable in the bitch during a natural mating? So we had a short conversation about this the other day on the Facebook page. So I have that information relatively at hand. So Jim, if it's fresh semen, the question that we want to ask is not how long the sperm are viable, but how long they can fertilize an egg. Like how, because there's research that shows that 10 days after a breeding, you can still find a living sperm in a bitch, in the oviducts, but one living sperm doesn't fertilize an egg. It's a much more complicated process than that. And they need other sperm to assist that are now called helper sperm. Within an hour, the sperm are up and starting their maturation process, which is called capacitation. And then they can start fertilizing eggs within that hour, but the peak fertilization rate for fresh semen, and I'm assuming fresh, but I probably shouldn't. Oh, natural mating. Yeah, fresh semen. Is 7 hours post-breeding. So 7 hours after the breeding is the peak of that ejaculate's fertilization rate. And then it continues. They've looked as long as 10 hours and then they just stopped looking after that. So we know that within an hour, the sperm can be mature and starting to fertilize, and then it gets better and better and better until about 7 hours. Now, those sperm can fertilize both mature and maturing eggs. And so we know that dogs ovulate immature eggs, and those eggs take about 48 hours to go through what's known as a second meiotic division. And that's really rare in mammals. That doesn't happen in most other mammals. But those sperm can get to those immature eggs and fertilize them. And then once the egg has gone through the maturation process, it can then go on and develop into a gamete or a puppy, an embryo. But how long that process goes on is, your best bet's probably to assume 4 days. So you've got about a 4-day window to get it in. Well, that makes sense if you think about our timing. We want to get it in. You can get it in on ovulation, but most bitches won't breed on the day of ovulation, but many will breed the day after ovulation. Then it's another 24 hours for those eggs to mature, and then they stay mature for another 3 days. So you've got almost one ejaculate can cover almost that entire period. Obviously, it's better to have more, but if it's a good number of sperm, then you've got that 4 days. Might it be longer? Yes. Should we plan on it being longer? Definitely not. Definitely not. You know, if you think about it, only 85% of natural breedings take, you know, actually succeed in a litter. And that's with everything working right, fertile bitch, fertile dog. And so we want to make sure we've got enough sperm in there that can fertilize as many eggs as she has ovulated. Okay. I'm going to keep going with Jim. Jim then just says, how often and many times should the male and female tie during the ovulation period? So the optimal for the vast majority of males is going to be every 48 hours from the day after ovulation until she's in diestrus. And that's typically when they won't stand anymore, but you can run a vaginal smear to check to see if she's out of season at that point. Really, really young, fertile males that have billions of sperm, they can breed every 24 hours. I would not recommend any more frequently than 24 hours because you're just not going to gain anything from it. You know, there's no real benefit if you can keep breeding the dogs. So every 24 to 48 hours, a lot of times you'll see people say that a single breeding will do it. And that's very true, that a single breeding can get a bitch pregnant. But often if we had had the opportunity to do a second breeding and we didn't do it, we will kick ourselves a really long time if she doesn't get pregnant. So if you can do a minimum of two breedings, that's great. Three is sort of typical from to cover the day after ovulation until the eggs are not ripe anymore. You're usually not going to get more than three. Some bitches will stand for 6 days, but they're not fertile anymore. They're just having fun. And Jim, if you're still, I'm looking to see, you're welcome to unmute if you.
I unmute, okay.
Hey.
All right, so that's perfect. That's exactly what I needed to know. You covered everything, and that's very helpful.
Terrific. Good.
Okay.
Excellent. Celeste, you wanted to continue on with that?
Yes. I first want to thank you so much for your such a detailed answer to my question as to how long it took for the sperm and all that, just and exactly what Jim was asking. And with that information, and thank you, Avidog, for the stud dog course. James, if you have not listened to that stud dog course, please listen to it because it is awesome. Well, anyway, poor Star, you know, she's had one surgical after another because her very first breeding experience, she was raped or forced to have
a breeding,
have a mating first. Anyway, so she did fine. The first time we did it, she ovulated Saturday morning. Yes, I knew the exact time she ovulated. All right, she ovulated, well, not exact time, but around the
time. I was just going to ask, was it 10:34?
Close. She ovulated Saturday morning. Saturday at about noon, we put the two dogs together, but the stud dog's owner was a little bit like, oh, nope, they didn't mate right away, so they're not ready, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I took the dog home, the stud dog home, which was wonderful. And that evening at 6:10, I put them both outside. I have a fenced in back area, and they tied for 17 minutes. And I have a question about tying. Does it matter how long they tie?
Not really. No. Okay. No, if it's more than, you know, if you have a 3-minute tie, it might be a little questionable how good that tie was. Okay. But
all right. But honestly, so anyway, I'm all by myself. It was a very comical, if anybody had seen this, they would have laughed. I mean, I knew that he had ejaculated because his back legs came in front of the bitch's back legs, which I was like, yay, stud dog course. And he couldn't get his back leg over because they're both about the same size. So I lifted it over, and thank goodness for my long arm span, because I was able to hold his collar and her collar and take my knees and go into a yoga position and put my knees into each rib cage and put them up against the outside kennels. So I was praying at that point for not a 45-minute tie. The next day, we waited 2 days because I figured, you know, the 48 hours. I put them in a room, which is now called my boom boom room. And we unfortunately,
I'm gonna put up that music on Facebook. You watch.
Yeah. I forgot my boom boom rug, so I didn't have a rug, and he was missing the mark. I mean, they went right to it, no foreplay, nothing. And that was Monday morning. And so I kind of freaked out, and I took them both to the vet and had an AI. All right. So that was when the eggs were ripe. I also had a progesterone. I cannot tell you, I mean, everybody knows this, but I'm going to reiterate it. progesterone testing is my best friend. I found out her progesterone at that time was 16.16. And what that told me was, yay, the eggs are getting ripe, but I still had time for another one. You know, if it was like 28, 30, 40, you know, I might say, okay, I'm at the end. So I love progesterone testing. So anyway, so I went to and bought a boom boom rug and put it in the room. The next day, I figured, well, I'm just going to wait 48, you know, 24 hours because he was young, and they went right to town on the rug, but he missed again. And this time I looked and he was going right between the anus and the vulva. And I said, ah, we have a height difference. So outside we went, put her on the top of a hill, a slight incline, and him on the bottom. He missed, got the mark, and we had a 20 minute tie. This time, because I was on a hill, I was able to stand up.
They didn't need to bring a crane in to get you off the
ground. Oh my God. It was, and if anybody driving by would have seen that, oh my goodness. And I was in my pajamas that first time.
Well, okay. The only thing you were missing was rain or snow.
Oh yes. But I wouldn't have cared at that time because I was saying, but anyway, so that ended my saga. And I had no idea that, that male dogs went and peed on everything afterwards.
Oh my God.
Oh, wow. I was like, oh my God. I had
before and after. Blood. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
Terrific. So it sounds like really good timing and good confirmation of your timing. Like you knew when ovulation was occurring and the progesterone confirmed it.
Yes. And also I had cytology. So she, of course she was in full estrus, but we all know estrus is estrus. So, And one of the first times she went into estrus on the cytology where there was absolutely no nuclei whatsoever.
Wow. So,
yeah. I mean, usually she has just a little tiny pinpoint.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And do you have diestrus yet?
No, I, let's see. Yesterday was the last tie. And that was the day that her eggs were probably starting to not be fertile anymore or you know, they were maybe they were all mature. But anyway, a great experience, learned a lot. And I just am so grateful for the information I've had and how I could have saved the money on the AI if I had actually looked. I did try to guide him into her. That was another interesting experience. He didn't like that at all.
Yeah.
He,
so let me tell you what to do when you have those experiences. Is it's somewhere in the stud dog course, but I didn't make a big enough deal about it. It's called vagina tipping, vulva tipping. And so we don't touch him, we manipulate her. And so because the end of the penis is just looking for that vulva, the opening in the vulva. So that's sort of what causes them to push in hard. And so if they're hitting above it or to the right of it, or heck, some of them are like hitting her ear and, you know, they can be rather unfocused sometimes. But if you face the same direction she's facing, you do have to usually get on the ground. And say she's on my right. I don't know if you can see. So she's on my right. I'm going to take my left hand and put it between her hind legs, under her belly, between her hind legs. And I'm going to put her vulva between these two fingers. And when you do that, you're not looking at him. You sort of have to not look at him, not touch him. But you can feel that the end of the penis, that very, very end of the penis. And so you can guide the vulva and you can do a fair amount of manipulation. The bitch will not care at all, at all. They have zero response to it. But that often will enable you to get a tie with height differences. Now, not huge ones, but height differences, boys that just aren't very coordinated, don't have very good proprioception. That is a technique that can be super, super useful.
I saw on my very first viewing of a natural, and it was my female, but it was a much smaller dog than the stud. And I saw the stud dog owner actually very quickly take his foot. He was sitting. He took his foot and he put it under my bitch's belly and just lifted up a little bit. And it was right there. And I, of course, I didn't think of that in the course of all this
excitement
stuff.
Of the moment.
Yes. But they know it worked. So and Star's confirmation is she's a bit tilted downward. You know, the top is what swells, and then she's a little bit more.
Yeah, so it sort of comes.
Yeah, exactly.
Not unusual. Cool. Well, wow. Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Yes. Now, I can't wait till my stud dogs get old enough.
Yeah, exactly. So you'll get lots of practice then.
I'm so excited, but I was telling you when he was missing, I kept saying to myself, oh, I just knew I should have done a surgical. I just knew it.
No, but you can't beat those ties. You really can't.
I certainly hope there's a pregnancy. And I will tell you that the first tie during ovulation, you know, the day that she had ovulated, was she was receptive, but the minute he was in her and she was locked down, she tried to move away. That second one where they tied for 20 minutes, the final one, she didn't move a muscle. I mean, she was just like, oh, okay, we're going to deal with this. So.
Not unusual, but the moving away isn't a terrible thing as long as they don't injure the male or move too much. But that pressure between the vagina and the penis actually can be helpful in driving. So it triggers her muscles. Yeah. So we don't have to hold them together. It's okay. Usually the bitch is putting pressure away from the male. You just don't want it so much pressure that, you know, she injures him. But if her weight is pulling them, it triggers more muscle contractions, her muscle contractions that assist in moving those her.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens in 30 days. So thank you.
Sure. Daryl, you want to unmute about puppy pricing? I pretty much always think we should raise our prices. So I don't know how helpful I'm going to be.
Okay, so I bred back, and so I've recently sent a litter home and, you know, had a price in mind and felt like my price was consistent with the others in my breed club. But when I was shopping for an alternative stud dog here in the U.S., I was using a Canadian dog. So I had already had a contract with that stud dog owner, but because of timing, I needed to line up an alternative. So I contacted a couple of stud dog owners and found that their stud dog price was far more than I had charged for my most recent.
Wow, really?
Yeah, a lot.
Wow.
Like $500 more. And I balked and I said, you know, I don't sell my puppies for that much. And I don't want to be that person in my Midwest. I live in Michigan. I don't want to be that person, you know, that breeder that's an outlier and selling my puppies for so much more. And
why not?
Well, okay.
Why not?
All right. So when I said that's what the breeder in Virginia said, well, everyone on the East Coast is selling their puppies for this or more. So you should. And I said, okay. So I felt a little bit scolded, but I didn't.
Don't feel scolded. No.
I want to be, you know, you talk about being in a community and being, so I did reach out to some in my Midwest and they had raised their prices, not as much as what was suggested. But Lord knows that I wasn't short on big investment and certainly, C-sections and shipping semen here and, you know, hoping for the best with two TCIs that did only one. I mean, it's going to be a miracle if we have a litter, but I just wanted to know about the ethics of it. I did Okay, I'm back. Sorry, I was getting a phone call. I did contact Good Dog and ask them for pricing information and kind of found out that the Midwest is a little bit less.
Lower, yep.
Than the coasts. So I guess, you know, I just need to like come to terms with it and decide what, because I, you know, I have people that either held over from my last list or are coming onto my list now. And I don't really talk about money per se. I need to, but I think they kind of know what the going rate is, but I think I might be a little bit higher than what I sold my last litter for. And that seems to be, I just want to be ethical, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you my opinion and then everybody else can chime in, but I really kind of struggle to connect ethics with our prices. I just think, so what do I think is ethical in dog breeding? Choosing good parents, choosing parents that are healthy with good temperaments, putting our heart and soul into raising litters, doing everything in our power to find the right homes, coach those homes, educate those homes, being responsible for those puppies for their lifetime. I think providing a good warranty or some sort of warranty that says, if there's a problem, this is what I'm going to do. I don't see pricing related to ethics at all. Pricing, just because you charge more, doesn't mean you're gouging your puppy owners. They can go somewhere else. But how much, Daryl, do you think you got paid by the hour for that last litter?
Oh, yeah. Let's not even go there.
I know. So why do we think we aren't worthy of getting compensated for not just our investment, which is significant, our direct investment, which is TCIs and shipping semen and all of those things. But we don't think that we're valuable enough to actually get paid for the work we do. And we do really hard work.
Yeah.
And so I grew up with the exact same thing. And early on, I said, this is nuts. Like, dog breeding is a wonderfully honorable profession and activity. And yet we go out of our way to pat ourselves on the back saying we're going to lose money. You can't breed good dogs if you lose money. You cannot do a good job if you lose money. You can only do a good job if you at least break even, and I think you have to make money. How do you invest in semen? How do you do more DNA testing? How do you get yourself educated? You know, how do you go to more seminars? If you think about how we should be compensated for the amount of especially top quality breeders who go out of their way. So the first time I really raised my prices, I was raising them a little. I happened to, this was back in the days where puppies were in newspapers. I happened to open the paper and the local commercial breeder was charging $1,000 more than my puppies. And I said to myself, oh yeah, I am so raising my prices. This is insane, Gail. So as best you can, just start noodling on separating your price from ethics and think about the other aspects of what you do is ethical, because you do a huge amount of ethical things. But what do we have to pay attention to with pricing? We need to pay attention to being able to place our puppies with the right homes at the right time. And if we raise our prices too high, and we now have 3 7-month-old puppies in our house, our prices were too high, or we're not advertising, you know, we're not marketing the right way. So I think that in many ways sort of caps how much you should charge. I have an issue. Well, I won't say I have an issue. I often, because I charge at the high end of golden retrievers, and people will, you know, get in on the conversation, they'll say, well, I want every family to be able to afford a puppy. I don't. I don't. I think that my job is to find the best homes. Now, you know, that doesn't mean I'm selling to the richest people in the world. I'm selling to homes that are going to care for the puppies well and really thrive with the puppy. So I think that's kind of your boundary. If you're higher than other people in the Midwest, you have to make that community, that social decision in the group of breeders, whether that really matters. But I would say you probably do more than the average breeder in your breed. You probably do more than 75% of the breeders in your breed. And so should you be at the high end? Yeah. And the third thing, before I shut up about this, is that where are your peeps? Where are your buyers? So my buyers are North America. I'm not looking. I live in the mountains of North Carolina. If I priced my puppies for local prices, I'd probably sell them for $250. You know, they no one buys dogs here. And so you have to, if yours is a local market, then yes, you need to look at local pricing. If yours is a national market, then you need to, you can then have more flexibility to move towards the coasts. If it's a North American market, then you're going to look across the US and Canada. So that's how I think we should be thinking about pricing. And it always makes me sad when I hear breeders feeling obligated to lose money. I just think it's a lack of pride, and it's an embarrassment about what we do, rather than saying, holy cow, who else in the world sells joy the way we do? Who else? I can't think of anybody. Certainly not cat breeders, just saying. I love cats, but, you know, anyway. So.
All right. It's a really good discussion. I appreciate it, because I do need to think. I mean, last litter, I really did try to sell close to home and did try to keep in the Midwest because of COVID. But I hear more and more about air nannies and, you know, people that are making, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal.
I saw it. In fact, I meant to put it up. The Wall Street Journal is talking about flight nannies. Like,
yeah. Hello. So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning with COVID, I think it was rational to say, whoa, you know, what the heck is going on? But now puppies are moving all over, at least North America. And I know some people that have gotten them overseas without big issues. I mean, no more issues than we always have getting them overseas.
Overseas is probably easier than Canada.
I agree. Yep. You got to know a trucker to get into Canada.
Yeah, my stud dog owner had a heck of a time getting a puppy out. And that's why I'm breeding back, because I wanted a puppy from that dog. And so it wasn't, you know, meant to be. So that's another reason for the breeding back. So,
well, let us know what you decide.
Thanks very much.
Can I say something, Daryl?
Sure.
I ended up raising my prices, and I'll just be honest, $800 a puppy. The reason is,
you raised them $800?
Dollars a puppy. Yep. I was a little high to begin with, but not that much higher. And I just raised $800 a puppy, because I do budgets. I figure out how much each puppy costs me, and, you know, on and on and on. But it is a seller's market, so that's a good thing. I rarely ever sell locally. I had one breeder tell me, well, you can't sustain that price in this area. And I went, yeah, that's why I sell in California and New York and all over. But the other thing is our supplies have gone up immensely.
Oh my gosh, look at Tultrazurl.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it has just gone up terribly. And I want to make a profit. And there's nothing wrong with that, even though they think I'm evil because I make a profit. And or I'm lying. I love that one. I'm lying. But we put more into our puppies than the average breeder. So why in the world would we charge? I have gotten zero lip about the price. Zero.
I often hear when people come to pick up, they're like, you're not charging enough for your puppies. You should be charging more. You know, that's from my buyers.
I did. I heard that from my buyers.
So feel it, Daryl. Feel it. Let it come in. Let it come in. You don't have to do it right away, but think about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Another thing I did when I made a big jump in my puppy price is I put it on my website, and then I was like, I wonder what's going to happen. And nothing happened. I got applications and people wrote me checks, and I'm like, okay, well, that wasn't as hard as I thought, because you can always lower your price. You can always lower it. So, okay, I want to press on. Good luck with that decision.
Thank you.
Sylvia asks about, what do you consider overuse of a stud dog? That's a big question, Sylvia, because it's very breed specific. And are you talking overuse genetically within the breed, or overuse as in physiologically for that male?
Physiologically.
Oh, physiologically. Well, if he's young, he'd be happy to breed twice a day. But that second breeding is typically about 60% of the first breeding. So overuse, in my opinion, is when a stud dog is not able to optimally cover the bitches he's being bred to, and he's not having optimal size litters.
Okay, that guy was just curious if, you know, using him on one bitch one week and a different bitch the next week, do I cover that kind of stuff?
Yeah, the only time that becomes an issue is boys that are subfertile, you know, who have poor quality semen or have problems with their semen. That's the issue. But every week, not an issue.
Okay, thanks.
Cool. Jen's asking about stud dogs that are much heavier than the bitch. What can we do for those breedings? So Jen, depending upon how different the weight is, that's an issue in bulldogs. And I had a friend where we tried to breed bulldogs naturally, and the difference in weight between a male bulldog and a bulldog bitch in this case, I think it was probably 25 pounds. He just crushed her. She literally, and she was not a puny bitch, she could not hold him up. So we did some holding of her as we tried to do the breeding, but that's really hard on the bitch because they're getting squished. You know, it's because normally when a bitch stands, she's her abdomen is not getting squished against her spine. But if you hold the bitch up, it is. So those, I mean, that's a big size difference. I don't know how big you're talking about, but an AI is certainly appropriate in that case. Having that much weight difference, though, can be problematic at the puppy end if the bitch is smaller. If the bitch is bigger, then the puppies aren't going to be so big that she has trouble whelping them. But if the bitch is smaller, then you want to make sure you don't go so large with the male that the puppies are going to be too big for her to whelp. That's a huge issue in bulldogs, but they all do C-sections, so it ends up to be a moot point for them. Okay. Stephanie, are you still here? Do you want to just unmute? I don't think I see. Are you there, Steph?
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Yeah, I'm still here. So I had a bitch who whelped her puppies on Monday evening, and she's got a rear breast that's very firm compared to all of her other breasts. So it doesn't have dimpling. It doesn't have, you know, those hard marbles. There's no redness, no orange peel, but it's very firm breast tissue.
Is it hot?
No, there's no heat.
Good.
Breast milk, but her milk hasn't really come in yet. And so it's hard for me to do that on any of the nipples.
So mastitis can absolutely start this early.
Okay.
But I suspect that it may simply be either a blocked duct or a different kind of breast tissue, which can be, you know, you can, if you go from the front to the rear, you can feel textural differences in breast tissue in bitches. So it wouldn't be unusual to have, you know, one that's a little bit different. But black ducks can become mastitis. And so my recommendation is to do warm compresses. Not, you know, you don't have to do them anally where, you know, you're doing them every 20 minutes or something. But a couple times a day, I would do that. And I would absolutely keep the puppies on that nipple to try and keep.
Yeah, they're happy to nurse off of it.
Right.
I think they're getting something when they're nursing. I've been, you know, alternating, you know, periodically throughout the day with a warm compress and with cold cabbage leaves, just because I figure it's not going to hurt. And maybe it's going to help because I'm not entirely sure what I'm dealing with. I don't know if it's just the architecture of her breast.
Could be.
Or if there is, like you said, like a block duct or something.
And block ducts don't necessarily become mastitis.
Okay.
They will often clear out over time, just with nursing and the change in milk texture and the strength of the puppies and all of those things. So it's not like you're moving down a definitive path that's going to cause a problem. It's just something that you want to be aware of. It's kind of like her temp's 102.5.
I thought it was 102. It was that earlier today. I just checked it. It was 101.4 just now. And the pups had been all over her. So I thought if anything, it was maybe going to be a bit warmer. But, you know, those first 24 hours to 48 hours, it's always like kind of high.
Always.
It was 103 yesterday at one point. But now it just seems to be settling down.
Yeah. So I think as you see her milk come in, keep an eye on it. You know, I know you are checking it regularly, but just keep checking it. And you're looking for that change in temperature, that marbling, or any change in her behavior. You know, if you begin to think, she's looking a little puny, then I would really get on it. But it may just go away completely once her milk comes in.
Okay, I hope so.
Ugh. I know. I hope so too.
You know, when you're sleep deprived, you just feel sometimes like you're maybe making more of an issue than there is. But then on the other end, you don't want to not giving it the seriousness that perhaps you need to give it. So it's just
I think it's
breeding. Oh my gosh!
I know. I would say it's a watch and wait situation now, but kind of have a plan. And one of the things that you could do, did you talk to your vet or did you take her in?
Yes. No, I've been in conversation with them and they're not overly concerned about it. They're just sort of keep an eye, just do what you're doing, just monitor. But they didn't feel like she needed to be brought in for anything.
Yeah. So an idea is, and I don't know what your vet's like and what your relationship is, but as you go into the weekend, you may want to say, can I get some cephalexin or can I have?
Picked it up yesterday.
Perfect.
So I've just got it here in case things tank.
Yep.
Middle of the night or something.
But- Perfect. Perfect. You know, you know, if you begin to see redness, you feel heat, you see dimpling, you're going to hit you've got cabbage in the refrigerator, you're going to do the warm compresses, you're going to leap into gear, but otherwise you're going to start her on antibiotics, but otherwise you're just going to watch and wait.
Okay. Thank you.
Fingers crossed.
There was a chance that it could just be possibly just the way her breast is.
It can be. Yeah. I mean, I've had bitches with, it truly is remarkable to me how this species has such a variety of mammary glands, nipples, tissues, numbers. You know, what species says, well, maybe they have 8 nipples, maybe they have 13, maybe they have 2 on one mammary gland. It's all normal in dogs. Weird, but normal. So it well could just be a change in the texture.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thanks.
I like Lori's comment. The puppy is free. The buyer's paying for all the time, effort, and cost that the dog breeder has put into them. And I think there's some tremendous, tremendous truth to that. Terrific. So wait, I had questions. Hang on. What time is it? Am I way over? I'm a little over. So hang in there. Okay. So one of the questions, it sort of ties into the pricing situation. Breeder says, I feel uncomfortable asking for a deposit when I know the litter isn't due for 11 to 12 months. What do you recommend? So I think this is actually a really good question to think about if we do go back to Daryl's comment on ethics. So I take deposits 3 years out. I mean, I take deposits a really long way out on a planned breeding of frozen semen that is really rare, et cetera. But I'm going to give those deposits back if I don't have a puppy for them. I'm going to give those deposits back as soon as I know, okay, the bitch didn't clear. I changed my mind about breeding her, something along those lines. So I think, I know we've talked about this before and a lot of people disagree with me, but I don't think taking deposits is a bad thing at all. And I think deposits give you the confidence that you have just increased the likelihood your buyers will be there for those puppies when you need them, because they have made a serious commitment to you. Now, you need to make a serious commitment back to them. I'll tell you where I think dog breeders have an ethical issue. I actually sort of got into this on the Good Dog Breeder page the other day. They take deposits from pet people, but if a better home comes along, they're going to sell to the better home. And I have an issue with that because our market is the pet market. Yeah, you may be trying to produce best in show winners. You may be trying to produce field champions. You may be trying to produce, you know, the next Rom German Shepherd. But our market are pet owners. And sometimes we treat them dismally. We treat them like they are unimportant and that they just, their feelings don't matter. It's like, oh, go get another puppy from someone else. That I have to tell you, I have an issue with. If you don't intend to sell those people a puppy, don't take a deposit. Just don't take the deposit. Say, get back to me in 6 months. Get back to me in 10 months. I'll send you an email. But don't take a deposit from them if you're looking for a better person. If you take a deposit, now, sure, you may not have enough boys, you may not have enough girls, you may not have the right color, you may not have all those things, but in your heart, you know, if I have that puppy, I'm selling it to them. And I think that's where I think it's really important for us to be ethical with our buyers. And this is people's emotions. You know, they want a dog badly. And they're willing to commit to it 11 months out. They're willing to commit to you 11 months out. I think we owe them that we aren't out there looking for a better option there. So should you take deposits? I do. I don't know if there's a should in it. It is hard to give deposits back. Now, it shouldn't be hard because you don't have the money, because that's what savings accounts are for, just saying. But it is hard to disappoint people and tell them that the breeding didn't take and your bitch doesn't have any puppies. You know, you do have to shoulder that part of the responsibility. So if you say, I don't want to have those conversations with people, so I'm not going to take deposits, I don't think there's a right or wrong there. If you say, I'm not going to take deposits, and you call everybody when your puppies are born and nobody is going to take one of your puppies because they already got puppies, I don't know what to tell you. You know, you didn't get a strong enough commitment from them. So, and that may not be a problem for you. You may have so many buyers that it doesn't matter. And so then it works for you. So that's my feelings on deposits. Anybody have other thoughts? Okay, cool. Last call for questions. Okay, tomorrow, 1 o'clock, Bob Hutchinson. Should be fun. It's always fun with Bob. November 19th, 3 o'clock. Raising Singletons. And even if you don't think you're ever going to have a singleton, I'd highly recommend you come because they seem to show up whether you want them or not.
Shoot me now.
Go ahead.
I just said, shoot me now if I have one.
I know. They're...
So you're going to tell us how to prevent having one, right?
I'm going to talk to you about why they happen. And we'll talk, you know, you can sort of make the plan on how to prevent them, but sometimes it's worth taking the risk. But we'll talk through why they happen. Aaron says, yes, we're having one any day now. Yeah, singletons are expensive little creatures. But a very, very good friend of mine who's a dandy breeder said to me 17 years ago, Gail, it doesn't matter if it's the right one. And she said that 2 weeks before one of the greatest dogs I've ever owned was born. And so in that case, she was a financial disaster and she was just a dog of a lifetime. So in some ways, singletons can be awesome, but you're definitely not going to make money on them. Brian, you have something about a losing weight class in there. So we just put out, let me see if I can find the link, just a little thing on Avidog Zinc on weight loss. Yeah, here we go. And it really is everything Chris and I think about weight loss. So start there and see if that's helpful. You got to put your email address in, but then you'll get an email with the link to the information in it. And that's a good start. If you do all that and it doesn't work, thyroid test. That should be last step is full thyroid panel from Michigan State. There we go. But it has to be the full panel, Brian, not just T4 that vets normally run. You got to do the full panel to really get a picture if you have a dog that is, if you have tried everything and your dog can't lose weight, that is symptomatic of hypothyroidism. So then you have to say why. And so dig into it with Michigan State. Okay, guys, great to see everybody. Hopefully I'll see you on tomorrow with Bob. And until then, I'm going to go put the cryptorchidism paper up on the Facebook page right now. So you should see that, or in the Facebook group, you should see that shortly. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.